From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, why the future of Milwaukee film and the future of the Oriental Theater are so closely linked.
Plus, we'll look back at the past of the Oriental, which celebrated its 90th birthday this month.
I think it was inspired by the discovery of King Tut's tomb in the early 20s and kind of drove this fascination with exotic other lands, and that's what they tried to create in these palaces.
And Joel Hodgson, creator of Mystery Science Theater, says there's a straight line from his Wisconsin childhood to the movie riffing series, and it starts with a puppet who did the weather on Channel 6.
You can imagine being a kid watching the news, and the news was so dull when you're a kid, and then having a puppet show up, this Albert the Alley Cat, do the weather. It was like winning the lottery.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. This summer marks two important milestones for the Oriental Theater on Milwaukee's East Side. The historic movie Palace turned 90 at the beginning of the month, and around the same time, Milwaukee Film, which runs the annual Milwaukee Film Festival, announced it had acquired a long-term lease for the space beginning next year. The theater is currently run by the Landmark Theater chain.
We have two segments about the Oriental on today's show. We'll start with Milwaukee Film's executive director, Jonathan Jackson, who joins us in the studio to talk about the theater's future. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.
We're having you here because this is such great news. Milwaukee Film has secured the purchase rights to the Oriental Theater, and it's been all over the news, but I thought it was a perfect time to come in and have you tell us about how this all happened.
Well, it's a very exciting, even heady time for Milwaukee Film. We have secured a 31-year lease. I love that length. I love being able to say 31 years. It'll be our 40th anniversary when our lease expires as an organization, but are just so excited that the Oriental Theater has been such a pivotal piece of the Milwaukee Film Festival. You know, we're kind of branded around it even, and that 1,100-seat main house is such an amazing, magical movie-going experience, and we couldn't be more excited or proud to, you know, now be the custodian of what I think is one of the best cinemas in the country or the world.
When did this all start? Was this something that was always in your mind back when Milwaukee Film got going?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always been passionate about cinema programming as well as film festival programming. I actually got my start in programming running the UWM Union Theater on the UWM campus when I was a student back in the year 2000. And I had always thought that to do the real work of the cultural development, the education enrichment, the community enrichment, we need more than just the 15 days of the film festival to do that. Now, we've already expanded our education programs beyond the 15 days, but to be able to screen films year-round and to do unique programming year-round, as well as just traditional weekly releases of cinema, I think that's really how you build a film culture and a film community. And so, yes, we talked about it loosely in some of our materials. I even have a letter that we wrote in 2009 that was an appeal for our Founders Club, where we talked about having a 365-day-a-year organization dedicated to film culture. This started for real about 5 years ago when we approached the owners of the building, Newland Enterprises, and Tim Gockman, their director. And basically, it was an exploratory conversation about some of the challenges we had as an organization operating in the Oriental Theater, but then the bigger potential of what that space could be for Milwaukee if invested in and if programmed with sort of a festival mentality year-round. And so the conversation and the process began about 5 years ago. My board of directors, which is now 32-person, thoroughly vetted it over the course of several years. We even visited a parallel organization to ours, the Seattle International Film Festival. They have the largest festival in the country. They operate 5 screens in 3 different cinemas in Seattle. And they told us, both our staff and our board, that they got their financial security as a nonprofit and really found their footing once they secured year-round cinema screens. And then over the last couple of years, we negotiated with New Land Enterprises for a lease that begins July 1, 2018, which is when the current lease that Landmark Theaters has expires.
So the idea is that in addition to the film festival and those 15 days and the other educational programming, you're going to continue with Milwaukee Film's mission throughout the year, but you're also going to do commercial releases. And so it's going to be sort of mixed use?
Yeah. And I mean, it's all going to be under the banner of Milwaukee Film and the nonprofit Milwaukee Film. There are actually a number of similar nonprofit cinemas around the country that we've studied fairly well that sort of run on calendars. They have a mix of first-run art films. You know, we would definitely focus on screening documentaries, foreign films, American independent films on weekly runs or longer. But then I also love the idea of doing festivals sort of throughout the year, mini festivals or series program, and even repertory viewing. You know, I think that in an age where we're all going into our little social media bubbles, I think public forums and spaces where people can gather and sort of appreciate stuff and appreciate it on the big screen is such an important thing a community needs and something I think a community-run cinema can provide.
Would you imagine collaborating with some of the other smaller festivals that pop up, like through UWM? I'm thinking of the French Film Festival, the LGBT Festival, those kinds of things. Is there an idea that you'll try to provide space for them as well?
That would be thrilling to be able to do that. Those aren't conversations we've had yet because we've just been able to announce the news. But I think the Oriental is just a magical space and can help lift up, you know, all sorts of events and organizations and expose them potentially to new audiences. We'd love to be the home for any number of those festivals. You know, I think a cinema like the Oriental Theater needs destination programming and special event programming. I think a trend you're seeing in cinema today is actually going back to the original days of movie going when you wouldn't go to the cinema to see a film. You would go for the whole experience of sometimes a double feature, including newsreels, a vaudeville act, special entertainment, sort of like an event experience rather than just going to see a movie. And I think a film festival provides that. And I think nonprofit cinemas around the country are starting to do that, where community partnerships and special events and music programming can help create a unique destination rather than just going to see a film and running away as soon as the credits roll.
One of the things you mentioned, of course, is it's going to be nonprofit, but you still have to meet expenses. How much do you expect ticket sales to be able to provide for that budget?
Well, what's exciting for us and one of the challenges we've had with Milwaukee Film running the Milwaukee Film Festival, which is not uncommon nationally, film festivals actually, you know, nationally average between 30 and 40% earned revenue and the rest completely fundraise, which is a big margin for a nonprofit. Now, nonprofit cinemas actually operate much healthier, more towards 50 to 60%. Earned revenue. And so we hope that our cinema, while running it, could provide for, you know, up to 60% of the budget, if not a little bit higher, while investing significantly into the education experience and the community partnerships to truly make it, you know, and earn sort of that nonprofit designation and fulfill our mission.
One of the things about the Oriental, as everyone who's ever been in it knows, is the decor. It is a spectacular place to walk into. Sitting in that big cinema is just an amazing thing. All of those original details there, the organ coming up out of the floor. Are there building issues that you have to address? Are there, you know, decorating issues, those sorts of maintenance things that need to be taken care of?
Those are all things we're actually very excited to look into and are raising funds for. We sort of haven't had full access to the venue at this point to understand all of that, but we intend to make a significant investment in the space. We know of basic things like, you know, the heating and the cooling is not operating at optimum efficiency, especially in that cavernous main auditorium. That's something we intend to look very carefully at. Some of the seating needs to be replaced. That's something we're going to look at. But we intend to do everything we can. And the reason we got such a long-term lease was that so we would not be afraid to invest significantly in the space. We intend to try to make the Oriental Theater, you know, unparalleled in the country or the world for a cinema viewing experience. That means investing heavily into the sound and projection technology, which we're very excited to do. But then also the decor has to be right and has to be, you know, not vulnerable to aging. And so we intend to look really closely at that.
So what about The Downer? It's such an integral part of the film festival. It's one of the places that a lot of the movies are screened. And it's its own little jewel compared to the bigger jewel of the Oriental. So is there a plan in the future? I know it's not part of this plan, yeah. But is there a plan in the future to try to also take over that lease as well?
Well, the Downer is currently under lease by Landmark Theaters and actually for several years. Milwaukee Film would never let that venue go dark. So if an opportunity arose, we would pursue it. What I would point to is part of our strategy, and it is about seeing what we can do year-round with the Oriental Theater and expanding our programming, but it's also about accelerating the film festival. And one of the pieces we have never had for the film festival is use of all five screens between the Oriental and Downer. And that's been my dream, is to create a hub for those 15 days of the festival where the east side of Milwaukee becomes like a cinema village. And we need those two screens at the Downer and we need the three screens at the Oriental. So we're desperate to have access to that for the festival. And the last thing in the world that we would ever want to happen is for the Downer to go dark. I would just add that we also still envision the other venues that we currently work with to stay a part of the festival and have a vision of single screen cinemas throughout Milwaukee, including the ones we use, but actually expanding more both inside of Milwaukee and even outside. So that's a long-term vision. That's more like 5-10 years, and let's figure out how to run the Oriental Theater first.
What about the film festival itself? Once you take, I guess ownership isn't quite the right word. Once you take occupancy of the Oriental Theater, is there an idea that you're going to change when it is, or is it still always going to be a fall festival?
It's always going to be a fall festival. We'd like to shift the dates back a little bit. Right now, we have an unfortunate overlap that's out of our control with the New York Film Festival, and that's really the start of the American fall festival calendar, and they get first dibs and exclusive rights on all films. And well, I think big, and we all think big at Milwaukee Film. We're not quite ready to challenge the New York Film Festival, so we'll probably move back a little bit, acknowledging when their dates are long term. But beyond that, we want to make a bigger and better Milwaukee Film Festival. A big piece of it is those five screens occupying the three screens at the Oriental and the two at the Downer. And then in addition to that, you know, we're going to have sort of more access to talent and content than we've ever had before, because we're going to be building relationships to screen the films year-round at the Oriental. So, you know, people are going to take notice of us, and hopefully there won't have to be as much begging as we've had to do over the years for the content that we have been able to scramble together for the festival annually.
So speaking of the festival, what are you looking forward to this year?
You know, we haven't announced any of the content as of yet. It's our 9th annual festival. And what I can say is that, you know, we've been working hard at Milwaukee Film to grow the local film community. And this is going to be a banner year for feature films out of the Milwaukee community. Several, I think, will be in prominent positions with the festival, hitting some, you know, very serious, some very funny, some thoughtful subject matters in Milwaukee. But it's just been astonishing to see the growth in the Milwaukee film community over our trajectory. And some of that has come with our investment in forms of grants and cash prizes. But I just can't wait to launch this year's festival and really highlight the dynamic artistic voices that are coming out of Milwaukee today.
Well, Jonathan, this has been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed. And I look forward to talking with you later in the summer when you can announce all of this year's film festival hits.
That would be very exciting.
Jonathan Jackson is the executive director of Milwaukee Film, the organization which runs the Milwaukee Film Festival and other educational programs throughout the year, recently signed the paperwork on a 31-year lease for the historic Oriental Theater on Farwell Avenue.
We'll take a quick break now, and then we go from the Oriental Theater's future to its past and learn about the 90-year history of the space. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we spoke with Milwaukee Film's Jonathan Jackson about the organization's long-term lease of the Oriental Theater, which will begin next year. Milwaukee Film will become the latest in a long line of organizations and individuals who have operated the theater during its 90-year history.
It is a fascinating history, and Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited the theater to learn more about it. From our film contributor Dave Lurson and the Oriental's current manager, Eric Levin. Lurson takes us back to the theater's earliest days.
Well, it was originally owned by the Sachs brothers, S-A-X-E. They, and Eric, you can correct me if I'm wrong on details, they were a couple of sign painters who did work in burlesque and early movie theaters. And the legend is that one of the movie theaters owed them money, and they collected the unpaid debt by taking possession of the theater. And they got into the business then of cinema. They operated a chain of movie theaters in the Milwaukee area, kind of, I suppose, a predecessor to Marcus Theaters in the sense of it being a regional operation. The Oriental then was going to be the crown jewel of the Sachs brothers' empire.
And I imagine the architecture in Milwaukee in 1927 was really diversified with this building and its East Asian inspiration. So why did they want this design, and, you know, what did it portray at the time?
Well, it's, in a way, it's sort of meaningless. It's kind of one of many confabulations of design that you would have seen as a movie palace. So they tended to be Mediterranean or Italian or quote-unquote Oriental. So the Oriental is kind of a mix of East Indian, Moorish, some other stuff thrown in there. I think it was inspired by the discovery of King Tut's tomb in the early 20s and kind of drove this fascination with exotic other lands, and that's what they tried to create in these palaces, kind of an escapist environment.
Well, think of some of the popular movies of the 1920s, Rudolph Valentino, The Sheik, set in exotic Oriental or Near Eastern places. So I suppose it was part of the whole idea of movies as an escape from the tiresome reality of everyday life. You not only escape into the movie, but the environment the movie is being shown in was also part of the escape.
And this building itself has been owned by various people throughout the years, but are there any particularly interesting people that have claimed their permit on this?
So the Sachs brothers were the public face, very public face. The owner of record of the theater, the guy who built the theater, was Mo Annenberg, whose family foundation at this point supports NPR and other charities. But Mo Annenberg was, from what I understand, kind of a rat. And he was described as the most dangerous non-Italian mobster of the, probably of the 20s and into the 30s, probably due to his connection to the Chicago outfit and the New York people like Lucky Luciano, who were enforcing his newspaper circulation business for him.
This theater now has three screens, but what was its original design? It was one original screen from what I understand, which also served for live music venues, and it has an orchestra pit, which isn't utilized as much today, but what was it truly like in its prime?
Well, I'm going to take a guess that the architects and the owners, original owners, were hedging their bets about the coming of sound film, because this theater has a lot of features that would have been more peculiar to the silent era. An orchestra pit for an orchestral accompaniment for movies, the Kimball organ. It seems to me that even though 1927 the transition was occurring, that they were ready to remain with silent movies if that would have been the case, kind of like, you know, these talking movies won't catch on, maybe, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think in 1927 when the theater opened, there had been some sound films. There had been films released by Warner Brothers much earlier than that. But yeah, sound at that point was not a given. So actually the first theater that opened in Milwaukee for sound was the Avalon, which was built, which opened in 1929, fully equipped for sound. The other theaters just had to pay their money, which was a tremendous amount at that point. At that time, to convert to sound.
Now, in addition to the film screened here, there was live performances. So do you recall who the first person or band or to perform here was, and how many acts have been here throughout the years that are most notable or any interesting stories from that?
Well, the earliest one that I am aware of, and he couldn't have been the first musician to play here, was Bob Dylan's notorious aborted 1964 concert where he stormed off the stage after one or two songs because something irritated him and tickets were refunded to the disappointed audience. In the years after that, there were some really notable things. There was the huge Violent Femmes concert in the 1980s with crowds lined up around the block. I saw lots of bands here. The last band I saw here was New Order, I think, early in 1987. And it was one of the venues that touring rock bands in the 80s, at least, would think of when coming to Milwaukee. Eric, do you know of like the earlier history? Did Glenn Miller play here? Were there big bands playing at the Oriental earlier on?
Well, I'm sure there were, but I don't have that history anywhere. I wish that was preserved somewhere. There must have been. But, of course, it was always primarily a movie theater. They also did vaudeville stuff, which I don't think a lot of people are familiar with now. But, you know, it was comprised of stupid pet tricks and mediocre singers.
Oh, like YouTube.
Yeah, very similar to YouTube. And that pretty much was passé by around 1936. So I know they did some legitimate stage stuff here, too. So there would have been some respectable live stuff with the movies as well. But vaudeville generally wasn't it. I mean, it was just a variety act, usually.
This theater is defined as a movie palace, and the Avalon is one of the other ones. But in the age where movie theaters today are multiplexes or stuffed in a mall or very big, blocky, uniform places, how important is it to keep the Oriental as it was originally intended to be a palace, to be an escape?
Well, when I interviewed Patti Smith recently, I asked her about her first Milwaukee concert in 1976, and what she remembered was playing the Oriental Theater. She couldn't remember the name of it, but she kept going on about that fancy theater, she called it. I mean, she'd never seen anything like that before. I think that it's an architectural gem. I mean, I suppose some purists would think it's an eclectic hodgepodge. I've always found it to be a very striking place. It's a piece of cinema history. Many cities around America had movie palaces, of course. Some of them have been torn down, including here in Milwaukee. Others have gone to ruin, but there's been certainly an effort in the past few decades to preserve them and to keep them running as entertainment venues. And why wouldn't you really want to come to an unusual, distinctive, and beautiful place to see a movie as opposed to a generic cookie-cutter facility? To me, there's no comparison. I mean, I think this is a cultural landmark in Milwaukee, and it deserves to be not only preserved, but enhanced as it goes into the future.
It definitely is a cultural landmark, and it's one of the very few survivors. Definitely one of the top 10 movie theaters in the country. It's been acknowledged as that. And I think it serves the same purpose it did in 1927. It still transports people to a different place that's probably even more foreign than it was in 1927, ironically. We get a lot of tourists in here. We've had people from Sicily, China, Japan, Germany. They've all said that there's nothing like this where they come from.
You, Dave, as a film critic, and Eric, your role here as manager and being a film fan, is there any film in mind that stands out as it was the perfect piece of film to see in this setting for either of you?
Oh, what a great question. Him and Haw about this one. What I can tell you from my early experiences here is it was the first place I saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show shortly after it opened. I guess it was perfect for that. But back in the 70s, into the early 80s, and even beyond a little bit, the Oriental Theater used to have these printed flyers that every hip person in Milwaukee had one on the refrigerator door. And it was kind of a way, to some extent, of planning your life. I mean, you'd look on it and see what was coming. Early on, there was an eclectic mixture of classic Hollywood. I saw the Marx Brothers on the big screen here, Duck Soup. I saw all kinds of classic films here. It was also one of the major places in Milwaukee where you would see European films. So rather than mention any one movie in particular, I would say that a lot of my movie education came from coming to the Oriental Theater.
And Eric, on that note of movie education, the Oriental is known for showing things that you're not going to see at Marcus and things like that. And of course, it's a big hub for the film festival here. How important is it to you to keep that going?
Well, it's very important. And it's important to note also that the films that Dave is referring to, primarily in the 80s, were responsible for supporting or launching a lot of careers, whether it was David Lynch or Werner Herzog or Fassbinder. It was really Landmark Theaters that was responsible for driving American interest in those filmmakers. There were very few other chains that were supporting their work at the time.
And just as a fun aside question, is there any statue, figure, painting, or anything in here that is a favorite of either of yours?
Well, I can't help but admire the black porcelain lions that line the stairwell going up to the balcony. But really, the eye rests nowhere when you walk into the lobby of this theater. I mean, everywhere you look, there's something. And there is a symmetry to it. It's not a confusing mass of chaos. But this is a remnant of an era when buildings were meant to be impressive and meant to elevate the people who used them. They were not merely functional. This is not merely a functional room with a projection booth at the back with lights on dimmer. I mean, this movie theater was meant to transport people into another way of feeling and thinking about the movies they were seeing.
I think my favorite visible aspect would be the lions also in the lobby. They're amazing, but there's a hard-to-see detail in the main auditorium that I like a lot. On the dome, there are a number of griffins, and they are standing on elephant heads. And I like to shine some light on those, literally, for people when we do tours, because they're ridiculous. It's a griffin with lighted eyes standing on the head of an elephant that looks like it's out of Disney's animated Jungle Book. It's so silly. So I think that's my new favorite decorative element.
And Eric, I've never seen it all these years I've been coming. Or it must be in the dark.
We'll show you the next time we have an intermission for sure.
I look forward to looking for those as well. But Dave and Eric, I'd like to thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thanks a lot.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper and a Lake Effect contributor. Eric Levin is the manager of the Oriental Theater on Farwell Avenue. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski as the theater marked its 90th anniversary this month. We'll take one last break and then we'll switch theaters to the historic Pabst Theater, which will play the role of a movie theater for the first ever fully live edition of the movie riffing show, Mystery Science Theater 3000. We will talk with the show's creator when Lake Effect continues next on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. And I'm Mitch Teich. A couple of years ago, we spoke with Joel Hodgson, one of the creators of the TV show Mystery Science Theater 3000. The show was a longtime staple of Comedy Central in the 1990s and featured a hapless guy shot into space sentenced to watch bad movies with the robots that he built. Here is a sample from the decidedly B movie, Teenagers from Outer Space.
Let me entertain you.
Fine, Derek.
You will wait until the sky is light enough to begin the search.
It is light!
We will leave now and return here to meet you when we bring the Gargons.
Go back to your planet, space teens!
Do not fail, Thor.
I shall not fail.
You fail! You cannot beat us! We're the people! We'll cope on you!
Run your fastest! Jump your highest!
Look at that stupid jumpsuit belted at the waist.
When we spoke with Hodgson, the show had been off the air for years, but a groundswell of support was building for a reboot. That turned into a Kickstarter campaign, which raised more than $6 million. And the series was relaunched with a season on Netflix featuring a new cast led by comedian Jonah Ray.
The cast has also embarked on a national tour featuring a full live show. They'll play two shows in Milwaukee this Saturday, one featuring the movie Iga from the original TV series, and the second featuring a surprise movie. Hodgson, who is a Wisconsin native, joined me and Lake Effect comedy contributor Matt Kempel on the line ahead of the trip. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, of course. I love Milwaukee. I grew up in Fort Atkinson, and so going to Milwaukee was like going to Avalon for us. It was great.
I was gonna start with Mystery Science Theater, but you kind of said something, and I don't think I've ever asked you this before. But do you have particular Milwaukee memories from your youth?
Yeah, sure. Going to the Milwaukee Zoo, obviously, and of course the Milwaukee Museum. And last time we were in Milwaukee, I got to go to the Milwaukee Museum, and I was shocked that Samson the gorilla is dead, and they've stuffed him, and he's at the Milwaukee Museum. That kind of was sobering. I didn't know, like, the mortality rate for gorillas. I guess in my mind, I guess I thought he'd live to be as old as a human, but maybe they don't live that long.
Well, I think he did, but I think you probably visited him at the zoo in his middle age.
Yeah, that could be, absolutely. But he was famous. Like, we would talk about Samson, and there was a rumor that he broke out. Like, there was kind of this urban legend that kids would say to each other, like, you know, Samson broke out once. But I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's true either. But he was famous, if I remember, for like when people would stand there, he would run up and start beating on the glass, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's true. Yeah, it was amazing. I had really happy memories of that. And what are the domes called? That's what I remember going to, too.
They just call them the domes. It's very descriptive.
So we went there, too, so I remember that as well.
Yeah, I think it's technically the Mitchell Park Conservancy, but everybody just calls them the domes.
Right. And we had relatives in Whitefish Bay, and I have friends in Cedarburg, so yeah.
Well, coming home is a good thing, and I guess that's as good a transition as any. And so my question for you about the live show is, you know, why was this the time to try this full production live versus, you know, the other models of live shows that have been done through the years, like Cinematic Titanic?
Well, a lot of the thinking in the new Mystery Science Theater, once we did the Kickstarter and we got funded, we made the shows, we ended up on Netflix, and it was kind of like that was always the plan to then roll out a live tour. And a lot of that thinking came from Cinematic Titanic and getting to do, we did 100 live shows over the course of like 6 years. And a lot of the way Mystery Science Theater functions now and the style of it comes from my experience, like being on the road and doing all those shows live in front of audiences and kind of understanding, getting an ear for performing live. So in a way, you know, prior to bringing back Mystery Science Theater, doing movie riffing live was to me kind of the state of the art. So after we landed Mystery Science Theater and it got on Netflix, that was kind of the next step. Was to roll out the live show and then bring it out there and meet all these people that kind of backed our show and brought it back to life.
So, Joel, what would you say is the biggest difference with this reboot on stage versus when you were touring Cinematic Titanic? Obviously, like, the robots are going to be there. There's going to be, you know, the feel of the show on stage. Is it a big production? Like, do you have like a Broadway style set kind of thing?
Yeah, it's, well, Broadway is different because, you know, they can build sets and they are permanently located and our show has to travel. But in a way, you know, Mystery Science Theater was kind of a reader's theater version of Mystery Science Theater, where we were just kind of standing next to the screen and riffing. And this is really in the context of the show Mystery Science Theater. So like you said, the robots are there and Jonah's there and we have the Mads on Moon 13 that are observing it and doing invention exchanges. And then we have, Kinga's evil minions are also in the theater, like Cynthia, who's the clone of Pearl Forrester, and also some of the boneheads are there. So they're all there, and I guess that's the biggest difference is this is an actual production where we see Moon 13 and you see the Satellite of Love and you kind of go through the opening of the song, the theme song, and see the doorway sequence, see the theater, all that stuff's kind of realized visually for you. So that's what I think is different is it's an actual Mystery Science Theater show from beginning to end where we have invention exchanges, sketches, and we riff a movie. So long story short, when we did Cinematic Titanic, we just riffed a movie and we just stood on the side of the screen and you know, kind of did it that way. And that worked really great, I think. And so it really encouraged me to want to do it with MSD, which is kind of where it all started, you know.
And significantly, one of the films that you're touring with is a movie that was from the original, your time with the Comedy Central version of the show. Why did you settle on EGA for the tour?
Well, it's interesting. We're actually doing two movies in Milwaukee, and we're doing one that's a secret that we haven't revealed yet, and we're doing EGA. And there's a lot of reasons. I mean, what's really funny about EGA is one of the most famous catchphrases from Mystery Science Theater is the phrase, "Watch out for snakes." And what's weird about that is it's not a riff that we said. If you watch the movie, it's not even clear it's a riff or a remark that any character in the movie made. There's just a scene in it where a guy's walking along and someone says, "Watch out for snakes," and you don't know who says it. And for some reason, that resonated with people in a really bizarre way. And so we were kind of thinking, well, who is the audience? Who is the audience? Who are going to come see us? And it's going to be composed of, you know, a bunch of people, but people who have watched the show, you know, since they were 12, like you. And there were also people who just came to the show because of Netflix. And so they might not be familiar with it. And so we tried to create something that people could identify with and use a movie that people could identify with. So long story short, it's all new riffs and it's all new sketches. It's just us kind of revisiting the film. It's kind of like some of our movies are so popular in the context of movie riffing. It's kind of like, you know, a golf course, you know, and it's like EGA is kind of like the 18th hole at Pebble Hill. You know what I mean?
It's your greatest hits.
Didn't you just have the Masters Open in Wisconsin?
We had the U.S.
Right?
Open. Yeah, actually, not
the
far
US
from
Open, yeah.
not far from Fort Atkinson out in Erin Hills.
So that was kind of the thinking with EGA, is just something that was familiar. And to kind of demonstrate this new cast and have them revisit one of the titles that people really liked from back when I was movie riffing.
I'm curious, have you had a movie that was really bad, you just couldn't wait to be able to make fun of it and then not be able to get the rights? Or has there been difficulty tracking down who owned those films? Is anything like that, throw a wrench into things?
You know, I guess the way it works is we kind of do it like you would buy a HUD home and fix it up. So we start with getting films we know we can get the rights to, and then we invest in looking at it and thinking about it and kind of how do you renovate the movie so it becomes a Mystery Science Theater. So we don't get really excited and decide we're going to buy a house before finding out it's for sale, you know?
Right.
So we don't like window shop for movies, and then because it's such an arduous process, because we actually have to get the rights to these films, and so you learn over time to not just don't go down that road unless you know you can get the rights to a film.
Can you contrast the production, how things take place with the reboot versus the way that producing the show played out originally?
Oh yeah, well, you know, naturally because of things like Skype and just Google Docs and stuff like that, you can work. We have writers all over the country. And back in the day, we didn't have that, going back almost 30 years. And we would all be in a room together. And basically everybody who worked on Mystery Science Theater lived within 15 minutes of my house. And we were kind of able to gather and get together at one place at a campus and kind of do that. And naturally now it's not quite so easy. And so what we do is we do kind of virtual groups where we'll watch a movie with Skype and do the same thing. So you have the group experience. And then we also have other writers who are working remotely with the film and writing their riffs. And then we composite all those riffs together. So we kind of, it's almost like we try to recreate. And also everybody at my office, we write. So we'll have a group here of six people. And so we're in our own way trying to recreate what we did initially, and also kind of the advantage of people being able to work remotely. So we have people working all over the country on it rather than just, you know, 15 minutes away from me.
I'm curious, like, how has that process been now being under, you know, working with a company like Netflix and taking that tour on the road? You know, it's incredible to see how technology can affect, you know, the work. How do you see this moving forward in the future? Like, what would be ideal as far as what you would want to accomplish with this down the line?
Well, we're really happy with how things turned out on Netflix, and the response has been really strong. I think we're at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes right now. I think there was an article in Business Insider that came out a few weeks ago that rated the top 24 Netflix shows, and Mystery Science Theater was the had the best like reviews from papers like the LA Times and the New York Times and the Onion. So as far as critical response has gone, we've done really well, and on the fans really seem happy with it. So that's, you know, we feel like we kind of landed the show back, and people seem content with how we did it. And so as far as the show goes, we just want to proceed. And the live show, we just want to go out and see what that's like and see how people respond to it. We think they'll like it based on Cinematic Titanic and doing, we did rooms roughly that size, 1,200 to 1,400 seat rooms. We did the Pabst Theater, and so we've done it with Cinematic Titanic. So I kind of expect it to go the same way, but what's really different now is we have Tom Servo and Crow and Gypsy, of course, and we have the sets and the costumes and the characters. So it's kind of a different experience, but I kind of expect it to go the same. So I'm hoping that it works and people like it.
Well, Joel, I know your time is short, but it dawns on me just how unlikely, you know, 25 years ago it might have been that you would have been referring to a Mystery Science Theater reference on Business Insider.
Yeah, ain't that the truth, right? Yeah, it's really funny. And thank you so much. We're thrilled to be bringing Mystery Science Theater live to Milwaukee. I can't wait to be there. Can I say one other thing?
Absolutely, of course.
I'm going to say this because I know that the people in Milwaukee will remember this, but when I was growing up, there was a puppet that did the weather, and his name was Albert the Alley Cat. And if you can imagine being a kid, 8 years old, watching the news, and the news was so dull when you're a kid, and then having a puppet show up, this Albert the Alley Cat, do the weather, it was like winning the lottery. I couldn't believe how great that was. Local TV was so influential on the creation of Mystery Science Theater, and oh god, what was that show, man? There was a monster show.
Oh,
I'm gonna forget it. Crap. but anyway, the guy who did Albert the Alley Cat also had a monster movie show at night on the same channel. I don't remember. Anyway, I wanted to mention that also had a big influence on me.
Well, right. It sounds amazing, actually, that you can draw like a line from Albert the Alley Cat to Crow and Tom Servo.
Yeah, it's really true. Like, if you think about it, like, there was a weatherman named Ward Allen, and Ward Allen would do the news, and then Albert would make fun of the weather. You know, he would do the Ward Albert was the straight guy delivering the weather, and Albert would make fun of it. So it's very similar to what we do.
and I think the idea of riffing the news is actually a pretty juicy topic for down the road.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look at Colbert, what they're doing, and you know, Seth Meyers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Joel, we're grateful for the time that you spent with us. And
oh, thanks so much, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, excited to have you back in Milwaukee.
Joel Hodgson is a Fort Atkinson native and co-creator of the original Mystery Science Theater 3000 TV series, as well as the relaunched version that is on Netflix today. He spoke with me and with Lake Effect comedy contributor Matt Kemple.
Two live MST3K shows will be on stage this Saturday evening at the Pabst Theater. You can find more information at WUWM.com.
Before we wrap up today, we have time for just a little bit of poetry. Here is Milwaukee poet Ed Mikowski.
This is called Everything is Arbitrary. You can't debate with memory or slow dance a regret. The music of my youth will always mean more than the music of yours. How does the insect population hope to support the spider population in my garage? The ape I am derived from is no more superior than the ape you are derived from. Wearing a condom is called pre-sponsible. New Jersey is the Napoleonic abortion of style. The path of least resistance is the path of least remembrance. Spend too long waiting for the bigger, shinier, next better option, and they all fizzle to a firecracker dud. Never wait for a white-haired, limping mall security guard to make you feel secure.
Milwaukee poet and Lake Effect alum Ed Mikowski with his poem, Everything is Arbitrary.
And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tomorrow on the program, our summer-long agriculture series continues with the first modern effort to grow rice in the Milwaukee area. You can, of course, find all the parts of that series at WUWM.com.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning and evening at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because fresh air is next.